It's 7:43 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Ghost tours in Harper's Ferry. Some just come for the history. Others?
I like the haunting stuff, and I always hope to see a ghost, so that's mainly why we came out there.
That story's coming up in just a bit. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. West Virginia officials named in a federal class action lawsuit involving the state's foster care system have retained outside counsel. Dave Mistich has more.
The lawsuit filed October 1st on behalf of 12 foster care children says Governor Jim Justice, Department of Health and Human Resources Secretary Bill Crouch, and other state officials have failed to protect the rights of nearly 6,800 children under the state's guardianship. The 100-page-plus complaint says West Virginia's foster children are housed in temporary shelters, hotels, institutions, or expensive out-of-state for-profit facilities where they never see a caseworker and are subjected to abuse. Days after the suit was filed, Attorney General Patrick Morrissey's office issued a request for proposals for outside counsel to handle the case. A spokesman for the governor's office confirmed Monday that Washington, D.C.-based law firm Brown & Peisch was granted a contract at a rate of $575 an hour for legal fees. The executive director of one of the organizations representing plaintiffs in the case says they agreed to extend a deadline for the state to respond. Attorneys for the state originally had until this week to respond to the complaint, but with that extension granted, the state now has until December 2nd. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Dave Mistich.
This past summer, the executive director of a nonprofit called Coalfield Development was awarded a $250,000 grant from the Hines Family Foundation. That director, Brandon Dennison, who helped found Coalfield Development almost 10 years ago, says the money will go toward a lifelong learning fund for his employees. The group operates mostly in southern West Virginia. It has about 60 full-time workers now, all working on different enterprises meant to diversify West Virginia's economy. Emily Allen spoke with Dennison. Here's some of their conversation.
How has, since 2010, this organization changed?
So in 2010, we started very focused on housing, and then we broadened a lot. We realized that an undiversified economy was really the source of so many of our problems in southern West Virginia. So I think then we started trying a lot of different things. And I think now we're starting to narrow again, not as narrow as just housing, but, you know, we've identified a couple different sectors of the economy where we think there's opportunity. And I think we want to focus on kind of using our models for unemployed people in these certain sectors.
Which sectors are those?
Yep. So I really like construction as a training sector a lot, because in construction, you can actually learn several different skills at once. The solar industry continues to just grow and grow and grow all over the country, but also right here in West Virginia. The agriculture, sustainable agriculture industry has tremendous potential. And then manufacturing. And I don't necessarily mean like huge 200-person manufacturing plants, but I think West Virginia is well positioned for like light manufacturing or bio-based manufacturing or artisan manufacturing. So I would put our furniture making wood shop in that category, or even our recycled t-shirt company Sustain You.
How many people do you have who were formerly, you know, experiencing unemployment that are employed through Coalfield now?
So we've created over 200 new jobs. We have just under 60 employees right now. So we have about 15 on our, what we call our core team. That includes the directors of each of the enterprises. Each enterprise has a director who's really the entrepreneur that knows that industry, whether it's t-shirts or agriculture or construction. And then we have crew chiefs who are experienced professionals that are really, they're the managers of the crews, which are the crews are made up of formerly unemployed people that we hire. So the crew chiefs are more experienced in that field. They supervise the crew members, but they also are really a professional mentor. And we've trained over 1,000 people. So when we have a training for our employees, we open that up to the general public. So that we can't hire every unemployed person, but we can offer some really good training and modern-day skill sets.
What are some things that have worked in the organization, and what are some things that haven't worked that you've learned so far in the last, I guess, almost a decade?
I think a lot of the, a lot of times it's never that clear cut of like this worked or this didn't. It's usually like, well, this part of that worked pretty well, but this other part of that could have been a lot better. So the trainings we've put on for professional certifications, in other words, trainings for not our own employees, you know, job training, if there aren't jobs at the end of that process to employ a person, they turn out, I mean, learning is valuable for learning's sake, but if I'm an unemployed person who's struggling to put food on the table, I'm not going to be very receptive to that message because I have immediate food, shelter, and safety needs right now. And so I think where we have the biggest impact is with our employees. So we, even though we're in lots of different enterprises, they're all tied together by our personal and professional and academic development. So we hire people according to what we call a 33-6-3 model, 33 hours of paid work each week, but 6 hours in the community college classroom towards an associate's degree, and 3 hours of personal development. So that's time to work on money management or time management or being healthy, you know, mentally healthy, physically healthy.
What has been some of the hardest parts in getting to where you are now?
The hardest part has been just how overwhelming and multifaceted the socioeconomic problems can be. And so it's like when you figure out one and you think you're moving in the right direction, another one pops up, sometimes even in the same day. So the health problems, the money problems, the debt that's built up, the transportation problems. Sometimes the hardest part of the week is just getting, helping all of our people get to work. Certainly we've run into the substance use problem. And so it's just, there are so many different facets, and one organization can't be expert in all those different problems. And so we try to very intentionally collaborate with other community partners who have different strengths from ours. And then you realize sometimes just the capacity, some of these communities, the capacity has dropped so much because so many people have left. And it's hard to think through how to build a whole new foundation that you can rebuild a whole community on. And yet that's exactly what's needed.
That was Emily Allen speaking with Coalfield Development Brandon Dennison. Harper's Ferry is well known for its American Civil War history. It was the site of John Brown's raid, the Battle of Harper's Ferry, and the town changed hands from Union to Confederate at least a dozen times. Harper's Ferry saw so much destruction during the war that many now say it's a town home to ghosts and hauntings. Liz McCormick went on a ghost tour there and brings us this snapshot. Up a series of steep stone steps, and just beyond a screeching gate, is the entrance to the historic St. Peter's Roman Catholic Church in Harper's Ferry. Built in 1833, it still holds Mass on Sunday and is open for special occasions like Christmas. But at night, and year-round, its courtyard is the meeting place for the ghost tours of Harper's Ferry, said to be the oldest ghost tour in America at nearly 50 years old. On this night, about 50 people have gathered to attend the two-hour tour. There are parents with young children, older couples, and a handful of teenagers. A lot are here from out of town, like Melanie Ray from Baltimore. She says she and her boyfriend were visiting the area and looking for something to do.
I love anything that has anything to do with history, and Harper's Ferry has a lot of, especially, I mean, like pretty bad history, like a lot of bad things happened.
That history is what makes Harper's Ferry a pretty cool backdrop for spooky tales. And tourists like Melanie are intrigued by that. Not everyone believes in the stories, but some do.
All right, let's gather around. We're going to get started.
Sitting in front of the doors of the historic church is Rick Garland. Rick is a local historian and our tour guide for the evening. He took over the ghost tours of Harper's Ferry 10 years ago. During the day, Rick runs a four-hour historical tour in Harper's Ferry, but at night, he's here, telling tales of hauntings.
Anybody bring a camera? Might be looking to take a picture of a ghost tonight.
Rick is dressed in Civil War era clothing and has a 19th century lantern he carries to guide the group. The Ghost Tours of Harper's Ferry was originally run by a woman named Shirley Daugherty, who started the tour in 1970. She has since passed away. Rick continues Shirley's legacy because her family asked him to and because he loves history. Rick also believes in ghosts, but he has a sense of humor about it.
Is there anybody here who does not believe in ghosts? Let's see those hands. What are you doing here? No, I'm going to grab my lantern and my coat. We're going to head out through the side gate.
With his lantern in hand, Rick takes us around the town, highlighting spots that are known for ghostly sightings. He encourages folks to take photos just in case they might catch something paranormal. At one point, we end up at a three-story stone and brick building, which is now a museum dedicated to the Civil War. Here, Rick describes how in the 1980s, a man and his three children moved into an apartment. But every night, the father heard a crying baby in his bedroom.
A few minutes later, the crying sound started up for a third time. It was louder this time. He's getting very fed up with this, so now he says louder, "I told you you have to shut up!" And he said, "The moment I got that out of my mouth, he saw something flash across his bedroom."
But when the father goes to check it out, there's nothing there. Later, the crying starts again, but this time, when the father yells, there's a crashing sound, almost like an explosion of bricks. Rick describes a possible explanation for the haunting. Apparently, a diary was discovered, written by a little girl named Anne, who lived in this building during the Battle of Harper's Ferry in 1862.
Anne continues to write, "When the Confederates are bombing our town, there's a woman upstairs in his house on the top floor with a newborn baby, a little infant in her arms, rocking the baby back and forth."
Rick says the diary entry describes how a cannonball smashed into the house, killing the baby and severely injuring the mother. The crowd is silent. A lot of the ghost stories Rick tells are connected in some way to the Civil War. By the end of the tour, many who came out chat with Rick, ask questions, and share photos of what they captured, including one woman, Cindy Rhodes, from Charlotte, North Carolina.
So that might be what they call a vortex, a bright light.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that is wild. That's weird. I've never seen anything quite like that before.
Cindy tells me that she and her husband travel all over the country to check out ghost tours like this one. The history, for them, is the biggest draw.
And that's what they're more fun for, you know, I mean, there's a ghost here and there, but they're more fun for the history, I think.
And for some who come out to these tours, like Brandon Schaefer of Baltimore, they like to be scared and to run into something spooky.
I like the haunting stuff, and I always hope to see a ghost, so that's mainly why we came out here.
Being a tour guide is Rick Garland's full-time job. And though he does other historical tours, the ghost tour for him is his favorite.
It's great to see how this affects other people. So if you can entertain them, whether it's with the history part of it or with the ghost tour part of it or the spookies part of it or a joke, The fact is that they want to be entertained, they came out to be entertained, and if you can do that for them, they feel good, you feel good, everybody has a good time.
Whether you believe in ghosts or not, ghost tours like these allow you to imagine, ponder, and wonder. Especially this time of year, as we approach Halloween, we all seem a little more sensitive to spooky things and to the curiosity of the unknown. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in Harper's Ferry.
West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.